Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
I spoke to the president about what's going on. I spoke in pretty clear fashion about how dire the situation is. He understands that. He knew that going into the call. He expressed his support for what the people are going through out here.
That is Governor Bob Ferguson of Washington State talking about his conversation with Donald Trump after the terrible fires that ripped through Spokane, forcing the evacuation of about 60,000 people. Now, there are lots of things that can be said about this. I plan to say a few of them in just a moment. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. To be with you, and I'm glad to include you in the conversation. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And as always, naysayers go to the head of the line. You want to send an email instead? It's talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can find our daily poll question on X at Lars Larson Show and on our website at LarsLarson.com. So the mayor of Spokane, Washington, Lisa Brown, describes the fires that ripped through that city. It was an area called Airway Heights. And believe me, I took that kind of personally because just about a week ago, my family and I were passing through Spokane and we overnighted at a hotel in the Airway Heights neighborhood of Spokane. And what happened there? Hundreds of structures, the latest estimate, although I'm sure these numbers are going to be corrected later, 700 structures, including many, many homes of people who live in Washington State's second largest city, simply burned to the ground. And it looked like the aftermath of the Palisades fires in the Los Angeles area about a year and a half ago. They call this the worst natural disaster that the region has ever faced. This is a city of about 250,000 people, and about 60,000 of those people, more than 20% of them, were forced to evacuate. The fires had spread to about 7,700 acres. And I know that for the most part, we're going to hear a lot of politicians like the former governor of Washington State, Jay Inslee, and the current governor, Bob Ferguson, and other politicians who are going to say immediately, this is global warming. It is not global warming. It is hot, dry weather, which, by the way, if you've never spent a summer in any part of the United States of America, let alone the Pacific Northwest, July, August, and September tend to be hot and dry. Global warming is not what caused these fires. Many of the fires that the Northwest region ends up facing, like those in Canada, like those in other parts of America, are the result of arson. They are the result of people, in some cases, flicking cigarettes out a window, lit cigarettes, or they're the result of people going out and deliberately setting fires. Do we know the cause of these fires yet? No, we don't. But I'll tell you one thing that I thought was very, very intelligent. I checked one of the sources that I like to check when there have been wildfires like this. It's the online presence of Northwest Hotshots. Now, what are the hotshots? They are brave young men and women who go out on these fires. Do they get paid? They get paid, but probably not nearly enough. It is hot work. It is difficult work. It is dangerous work. And they have an online presence. And here's what they wrote. The wildfires in the Spokane area are being driven by dry fuel, high winds, low humidity, and ignition sources. Now, in line with this argument that this is somehow all about global warming and this is something brand new, how long have we had dry fuels, high winds, low humidity, and ignition sources in July and August in most parts of the United States, and the Pacific Northwest is no exception? They say these are land, they are weather and land management realities, not a simple morality play about big oil. I mean, even the hotshots understand this is not about global warming. It's not about fighting big petroleum. They said what actually makes these fires larger and harder to control is decades of policy failure. In other words, these are avoidable occurrences. I've been pointing out to you for a long, long time that there are periods of time in the United States in recent history, the 50s through the 80s, where the Pacific Northwest region did not see gigantic amounts of wildfires. In fact, in that one 30-year period from the mid-50s to the mid-80s, there was one fire in that entire one-third of a century that went north of 100,000 acres. What's on fire right now? More than 2 million acres on fire right now. The typical amount of fires in the Pacific Northwest region is 500,000 acres every year in Oregon, 500,000 acres every year in Washington. And if you simply ask the logical question, what would cause us to go from a 30-year period where we had no big fires but the one? The one fire that would have counted as a pipsqueak fire compared to what's going on right now? It's because of bad management of land and forest and wildlands. And what the hotshots themselves say is aggressive fire suppression without enough follow-up thinning or prescribed, fire allowed fuel loads to build to dangerous levels. So what happened? There were programs that were in place to go out and reduce the amount of fuel, to trim down forest areas, to trim down areas where wildfires can go in brushy areas and grassy areas. Environmental rules and activist lawsuits, as we pointed out last week before the Spokane fires ever happened, have repeatedly delayed or even blocked mechanical thinning. That means going out and cutting back all the grass and the brush and the smaller trees that create the fuel for all this. Salvage logging has been virtually prohibited on public lands. Controlled burns on public lands are limited. Projects that would reduce fuel often sit in court for years or they get scaled back. The result is dense, more continuous fuels that turn what used to be manageable fires into fast-moving, high-intensity fires when the weather turns dry and windy, which, by the way, go back and take a look at the historical record. We've had our meteorologist on this show any number of times. If you say, wow, it's really odd that July and August are hot and dry, people are going to look at you like you have your head screwed on sideways because you say, don't you understand it's hot and dry every July? Well, it's a little bit hotter, or it's a little bit drier, or we have an occasional day that goes to a new temperature record. Although, if you talk to the meteorologists again, they'll tell you that there are an awful lot of temperature records that were set about 100 years ago and have not been eclipsed today. Blaming oil companies, as the hotshots point out, skips the actual causes. The American West has always had fire for literally thousands of years. They say the difference today is heavier fuel loads created by management decisions and legal obstruction. In other words, if Bob Ferguson wants to know what created the conditions that led to 60,000 people evacuated, 700 homes burned to the ground, all of this disastrous activity, all he needs to do is walk in and take a look in the mirror, because that's where the problem starts. It starts with government deciding we're going to limit things that have been going on for thousands of years that could have headed off this problem, and we're going to make the problem happen, and it's going to be even worse. Back in a moment. Glad to be with you on a Monday. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Vision. Do you have
if you don't want to talk but want to be heard, email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Well, this this weekend's deadly incident at an In-N-Out Burger in Twin Falls, Idaho, should serve as a great warning for those of us who make our homes in Oregon and Washington. The best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy or gal with a gun. Police say that 24-year-old Chad Williams showed up with a semi-automatic rifle on Saturday afternoon in Twin Falls, leaving three people dead and seven people wounded. That is a terrible tragedy. The good guy, 35-year-old healthcare worker Jordan Salinas, who saw the killer just as Jordan and his girlfriend arrived at the In-N-Out. He drew and fired his concealed carry pistol. Police have identified Salinas as a hero in this situation, as they should. While the killer coward Williams ended up taking his own life, it was shots from Jordan Salinas' gun that drove the killer away from the scene and away from other victims. Incompetent public policy, defunding of police, liberal judges and prosecutors make the Northwest a much more dangerous place than it ever has been. When police response times to real emergencies now exceed 20 minutes in places like Seattle and Portland, citizens must prepare to defend themselves, just as Jordan Salinas defended people he didn't even know. And the legacy news media, they would encourage self-defense by using honest language. This is for my friends who are reporters in television, in radio, in newspapers, or online. Call the killers killers. Don't just call them shooters. Call them killers. And call the good guys and the gals with guns heroes when they deserve it, as Jordan Salinas surely does. Our question of the day is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's really causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Eric writes in, Lars, the WNBA is like the Democrat Party and the Democrat Socialists of America. They need two leagues, the LGBTQ NBA and the other only women players. Let the gays have their co-ed league out of their own, and the other league has only women players. The Democrats have two parties, but the end goal was always communism. The new communist Democrats must pledge to hate Israel and vow to confiscate all Jewish wealth. New communist Democrats want to control the Rothschilds and all the Western banks in the U.S., signed Eric Eckert. And my favorite post of the day today from Oregon Catalyst, the abandoned building that business was blocked from restoring has gone up in flames. You might have heard this interview within the last 2 weeks with a guy by the name of James Casper, who came on this program to talk about his plans for Centennial Mills. He wanted to build a nightclub, but the city delayed him. City of Portland decided to put so many permits and denials in his way, it never happened. And because the building is vacant, it attracted many homeless squatters. And guess what just happened? It went up in flames this past weekend, so take that into account. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Well, let's give today's Daily Grill to both the governments of Oregon and Washington for all the crazy rules and regulations that they have used to create the dangerous fire situation we're in. Oregon has just broken its own record for total acres burned during a wildfire season. And by the way, there are 2 months left in this year's wildfire season, and they've already gone past 2 million acres. That is absolutely insane. The previous record was from 2024 of 1.93 million acres. And as I pointed out, none of this is necessary. All of it is preventable. And would that we could go out and get governments that would actually meet the needs of the citizens and solve the problem before it catches fire. Let's go to Steve, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program. What's on your mind on this Monday?
Happy afternoon. Sir, you missed something with that fire introduction. People that are towing trailers need to adjust their chains properly so they're not hitting the road and throwing sparks. I'll bet you right now, $5, that those chains cause more fires throughout the Northwest because people just hook it up. It's overweight for their vehicle, and it bounces down the road throwing sparks.
You may be right about that. I don't think the chain, I'm well aware of chain-driven fires, but I didn't miss that. I said most of the fires are either intentionally set by arsonists or they're caused by humans And if you wanted me to list every single way that people can cause fires with bad mufflers, with thrown cigarettes, I mean, you could probably come up with a couple of dozen different reasons. But I don't think you would find, and I'll see if I can find some statistical support for this. I doubt that chain-caused fires are actually the majority of fires. I'd be willing to bet that thrown burning material out of automobiles is probably the number one cause, and arson is number two. But Steve, I appreciate you correcting me, even though I mentioned that human beings are the primary cause of fires that happen. And then, of course, you've got lightning strikes as well. Let's go to Mike. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You pretty much covered most of everything that I wanted to talk to you about, except for one thing.
What's that?
Remember the people who had Global Supertanker?
Yep, I do. I covered that story for over 20 years until it was finally decommissioned for no good reason because the U.S. Forest Service and Oregon and Washington would not use it.
I know. It was crazy because I kept calling Washington state representatives, why aren't you using this? And they gave a plethora of reasons why they thought it couldn't be used, but, you know, in the end, it went away, and that would have been a very valuable tool for fighting these fires.
What Mike's talking about is the 747 that was actually created by Del Smith at Evergreen Aviation before he passed away and before Evergreen went away, and then the technology was bought by another company that operated out of Colorado Springs years ago. And in the end, the U.S. Forest Service would not use it. It was licensed and approved and certified by the FAA. It was literally the biggest firefighting piece of equipment on planet Earth. There was only one like it, and it was bigger than all the other ones. It had tremendous advantages, and it was cheaper per gallon drop than every other way of putting retardant or water on fires. And for whatever reason, government would not use it, and the U.S. Forest Service and BLM never would give a reason. Never any reason for not
the
using
Lars it. The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, interviews, podcasts, local and national news. Get it all at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It seems that there is lots and lots of bad government going around in both Portland and Seattle. I want to focus, before we get to talking about Seattle and Katie Wilson and her firing of the police chief just as they were heading into major summer events in Seattle. But let's go to Portland and talk about a signature gathering effort to get some more money to hire some more cops. And now it appears that city officials have been trying to defeat that measure before it ever makes the ballot. So Aaron Schmaltz joins me now, president of the Portland Police Association, the labor union that represents the men and women in blue. Aaron, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lars.
Let me ask it to you this way, just directly. Do you think that City Hall is trying to kill this thing so voters never even get a chance to vote on it before we get to the merits of whether or not this is a good idea and a good way to fund the cops?
Yeah, and that has been the effort throughout. I've been pretty overwhelmed by, I mean, none of this has ever been about, you know, debating the ballot measure, debating policing, debating all the things that we need in our city. It has always been about silencing a perspective that is different than a handful of elected officials and bureaucrats within the city ecosystem.
Okay, is that legitimate for people who are elected officials in a state and a city that has the initiative petition and the initiative and referendum, for elected officials to say, we don't want the people to vote on this because we're sure we're going to be unhappy with what they tell us to do, so we'll just keep them from voting on it? That seems completely antithetical.
Yeah, this really gets down to just the core principle of giving voters voice, which is the purpose of the initiative process in Oregon. And I've been honestly pretty astounded by, you know, it's like if you complain, then they compare you to things they don't like to try to scare people. You know, it's, you know, you're a you hear a lot from our elected officials. If you don't agree with them, they immediately say, well, you're conservative, and thinking that will solidify support for them or whatever. But this is not a political, like left or right issue. This is a core principle of our society. And when you have doubts about the behavior of bureaucrats within systems, you know, I come from a world where accountability and transparency are demanded. My officers walk around with cameras that show everything they do, and yet we're supposed to just believe when you have obvious evidence of mistakes or inaction or potentially crime occurring, we're supposed to just ignore it and pretend that it didn't happen.
Okay, and by the way, I don't mind if they say if you're going to gather signatures, they have to be gathered the right way. You have to confirm that they're registered voters. I used to be a Portland voter. I'm not a Portland voter anymore. But having said that, for a city elections official to grab cell phone footage that becomes part of a complaint, that sounds like a violation of the Hatch Act, you know, where you're not allowed to spend public resources on a political activity. I'm sure that covered some of the things that you're restricted from doing as a cop or as the head of the PPA. It should cover people at the elections office, too, shouldn't it?
Well, it is illegal for anyone to audio record anyone without permission in Oregon. But I think, you know, the way this has been framed is so bizarre. It isn't as if this individual was walking around and just saw something and reported something. There was a challenge to our ballot title. One of the opponents who lost in court was working in concert with a city elections official and the Democrat Socialist of America lobbyist to do that work, to try to discredit instead of just allow voters to have a say. And we're all about transparency and accountability. And if we make mistakes, then there are ways to navigate that. But I mean, we had reports of people harassing and stalking and screaming at people who wanted to sign. I mean, there was just so much stuff going on, and certainly anyone in a professional capacity working for the government has higher level of standards for their behavior on and off duty. And it's been shocking to see some of our folks in elected office, pretend otherwise.
Well, and Aaron, as I understand it, you're closer to this than I am. They're making an issue of the way that some signatures were approved and then the same signature would be disapproved on another sheet. Can you talk about that and the use of, I think they were faulting phone numbers that were put on the initiative petition sheets. Describe that if you would.
So there were 498 pages that the city disqualified. And to be clear, 12% of the signatures turned in on our measure were disqualified, and only 2% of the participatory budgeting measure were disqualified. And of those 498 pages, a full 200 plus were entire sheets disqualified because they said that the signature of this circulator did not match their driver's license or other government document. These are employees who were background checked, who had GPS locators on them everywhere they went. We knew who they were. And frankly, the city said some of their signatures were good and some of them weren't, and we've never gotten an explanation. And so you have thousands of signatures that were just summarily removed and never considered because someone somewhere said, I don't think that looks close enough, which is not at all statutorily or just from a common sense standpoint what should be happening. And we've never been able to get any clarity or explanation. And the city never told us they removed the pages. And they also changed the page numbers so we couldn't check their work.
Oh, hold on. That's transparency, where they disqualify signatures but say, but we're not going to tell you why or how?
Yeah, they didn't tell us why until we caught it. And then after we caught it, they said, well, you should have complained before it got to the county, but we didn't know it occurred. And again, there's just been a myriad of mistakes made, and all we're asking for, we're not asking for a preordained outcome. We're asking for clarity, transparency, and to ensure that the process worked. And look, if we don't have enough signatures once that process is done, then that's what happens. But yep, the fact that we are working so hard, or that the city and that some of our opponents are working so hard to prevent voters from having a say on an issue of this great importance, indicates to you the kind of problem we have in Portland.
And by the way, Aaron, I just so I'm clear, if somebody were to say to me, should we take money from a climate measure and divert it to police, I'd say no, except that I've never thought this was a climate measure. I thought it was to create a slush fund, which can be used for the MoDa Center and be used for 1,000 other things. Do I think that's what should have happened? I don't. But now that they've decided to treat it like a slush fund, if they're going to treat it like slush fund money, no matter what it was originally gathered for, then spending on the cops is the best kind of slush fund spending I can think of.
Yeah, I mean, the problem we have is that the Clean Energy Fund's original document, original measure, that work is critically important. And the other reality is that it is raising five times the amount of money, and we have a conversation over and over and over again every year at the bureaucracy or elected level how to spend that money. And so since voters had a say in that money being allocated to begin with, it seems kind of common sense that they should have another say in how any excess money or any money that wasn't intended to be gathered is being used, because it's their tax dollars to begin with.
So where does the measure stand at this point? Is it defeated yet?
Well, we haven't heard on the second count, but again, the original sin, what the city did, so necessarily set us up for failure that we are hoping that there'll be some intervention from the Secretary of State to demand some transparency and clarity. He did write a letter telling him that it was obvious there were problems.
Very good. Thank you, Aaron. If you're losing it and you want to get it back.
If you're surrounded by Northwest liberals.
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails. The Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. And we're serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And all three states tend to have some problems at one level or another. At some point, I'm going to talk about Katie Wilson in Seattle and her firing of the police chief, even though, you know, I didn't like the fact that the police chief was working as effectively a part-time employee and commuting from Chicago, Illinois. But having said that, the numbers appeared to suggest that Sean Barnes, the police chief, was doing a reasonably good job and doing what the city of Seattle asked of him. And then Katie Wilson decides that because she's been embarrassed, that she's going to fire Sean Barnes and then pay him $700,000, 2 years' salary, for him to go away. If anybody thinks that is a good idea, I'd be glad to hear the naysayer call, because I think it's an extraordinarily bad idea. But glad to have you with me on a Monday. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And this segment of the show is brought to you by eLegacy. You've spent your whole life building up your wealth. Don't leave it unprotected. Set your kids up for success the way Tina and I did by creating a customized estate plan with eLegacy. Go to eLegacyLars.com and set up a complimentary consultation. That's eLegacyLars.com. And our ex-poll question today, should the law offer tougher penalties for drone intrusions during wildfire emergencies like the fires that caused the evacuation of 60,000 people over the weekend in Spokane up in the Airway Heights neighborhoods and the areas that caught fire? I mean, more than 700 homes and buildings burned to the ground, 60,000 people evacuated, many, many people who were without power. Thank God nobody was seriously hurt, nobody was killed as a result of those wildfires. But then you get knuckleheads who decide they want to put a drone up over the fire area, which is restricted airspace. And the minute a drone is spotted, then all the other official aircraft that are actually up there trying to help fight the fire have to be put on the ground until they can stop the drone. But even if you get caught, it turns out the penalty is about a $500 fine, and that's if they catch you. If they prosecute you, then it's a $500 fine. I think there ought to be much tougher penalties. They have been able to cite two individuals, but that they were unable to identify some of the other drone operators. If knuckleheads do not understand, you can't put drones up in a restricted airspace where those airplanes fire are actually doing important work, and you're doing what amounts to being a looky-loo. To your calls now. Let's start with George. Hey, George, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, it's a day before the election, but I'm worried about defeatism. I know a lot of people on the conservatives, Republicans, they gave up. They threw down their guns. They surrendered. All they talk about is moving.
Yeah, that's a problem. So how do you get them re-enthused, George? Because I encourage people to vote. Tina and I are going to be, as we do every year, delivering our ballots to the elections headquarters tomorrow morning on Election Day, because I still like to mark Election Day, and because I don't want to throw my ballot in the mail, I want to make sure it actually gets there. I'm going to take it there in person. How do you get Republicans or conservatives, because they are different, how do you get them fired up again about participating in the system?
Here is you said you have to turn it in because you can't trust the mail because they're going to throw it away because they know you vote Republican. That's
I didn't that's say those words. I didn't say those words, did I? No.
But it's an impression. And what it is here is that nobody trusts the elections and nobody wants to mail in a ballot. Nobody, so they ain't going to turn it in. They ain't going to vote. They're just going to move to Idaho. And that's all they talk about is moving to Idaho. And we're going to lose another, you know, we've already lost.
Who is they? By the way, George, I get uncomfortable with people saying they. Are you talking about you? Because you're not talking about me.
I'm talking about face-to-face conversations with a lot of people about voting, about elections. And you know, if you actually look at the turnout.
So you're hanging out with people who are that defeatist, George?
You know what? It's just about anywhere. I don't know.
Well, it sounds like you're hanging out with a bunch of losers, aren't you?
Well, you know, they're losers because they don't cast ballots. But here's the other thing.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Why are you hanging out with losers?
Okay, let's talk about a 30% voter turnout in a lot of voting districts.
Yeah, that's
true. That's a lot of losers. That's 70% of registered voters. 70% of registered voters. And you ask me who I'm talking to.
Yeah, except that you said it's face-to-face conversations. You apparently have a lot of friends who've already given up, right?
Not necessarily friends. Just people that, you know, when you get into conversation, like in a bar or a coffee shop or, you know, maybe at work, you know?
Do you ever tell, by the way, George, just so I know where you're coming from, do you ever tell those people, that's a loser attitude. We never stop fighting for our country. Do you ever tell them that?
What I tell him is that what Reagan's speech in 1964, he said, I forget the title of that speech.
A time for choosing.
We lose freedom
here. A time for choosing.
Yeah, time for choosing, because Reagan spelled it out in 1964.
Yep.
He said, if we lose freedom here, there's nowhere to run to.
And that's absolutely right. I encourage you to tell those people, get out, get your ballot, and vote, and don't be a quitter. Let's go to Weston. Hey, Weston, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, I just wanted to make a quick comment about those drones you were talking about over the restricted airspace.
Over the fires.
And you know what? $500 doesn't seem like it's nearly enough for something
I agree.
That dangerous.
That's why we made the question, should the penalties be a lot tougher? Now, what they
absolutely,
should actually be.
Absolutely. You know what? Okay. Getting all those aircrafts back into the air costs a lot of money. And you know what? If someone thinks that they're important enough to put those aircraft back down, they're important enough to pay for it when they get back up in the air.
That would be an interesting penalty to say, okay, we figure the cost. But how do you calculate the? Because here's what I'm worried about, Weston. Let's say you've got a spotter plane up top, and they're watching so they can tell the ground crews, move to the west, or you're in danger, the fire is going to overrun you, move to the east. In other words, they're directing the activities from up above. How do you calculate the cost if that plane has to go to the ground for 20 minutes before it comes back up, and you put all those people at greater risk, and all that information they were getting from the Cessna up top is not coming in? How do you put a price on that?
You know what? That's a good question. There's someone out there a lot smarter than me who could answer that question, I'm sure.
I'll tell you what, Weston, let's come up with a really, really tough penalty. And tell people, you want to put your drone up, put it up when it's legal. If you get in the way, it's like somebody staying on the road when a fire truck is coming at you, lights and siren. Get out of the way. You're part of the problem.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News
101.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet Pacific.com.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Mars.
And
Mars.
Now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. We serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. And today, we're talking a lot about fires. We have an unprecedented number of fires that are going in both Oregon and Washington. And of course, over the weekend, we saw the evacuation of more than 60,000 people from the western side of the city of Spokane, the Airway Heights area. Three big fires burning there that consumed more than 700 structures. And I thought we'd talk to Todd Myers about that, Vice President for Research at the Washington Policy Center. Hey, Todd, welcome back.
Always nice to chat with you.
I mean, my audience is used to me suggesting that government is usually horrendously incapable of handling serious problems. And just before you and I began to talk, I got a press release from a major county in Oregon, that's Multnomah County, and they helpfully reminded people that there is a ban on firing up your wood stove in the hottest week so far this summer. So I'm sure that'll be very useful that they've prevented people from burning a fire in their wood stove or their fireplace during, say, Wednesday when it's going to hit 100 degrees. This is the level that passes for competence in local government is my experience. And I think Spokane is a great example of where preparations could have been done that would have made that place a lot more fire safe. And they weren't done primarily because of government incompetence and because of obstructionist attitudes from the so-called environmental crowd. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that those things are, you know, when all is said and done, I think those things are going to have played a role. Just to the west of where the fires are now burned a few years ago, and there were structures lost in Medical Lake and those other areas. So this is not the first time we've seen fires in this area. There have also been fires all summer long in other parts of the state in more wooded areas. So, you know, one of the things that people say is that we need better, do a better job of managing forest health and thinning and forests and doing things. That absolutely is true, and that may play a role in this situation, but it certainly plays a role in the area around it, and we've done a very poor job. The federal government has particularly done a poor job, and so when, you know, the Forest Service and the Colville tribes previously, who actually do a really good job of managing their forest, tried to promote good forest health and tried to do some timber harvests, actually Spokane environmental groups sued to block it, to stop some of those very things. So it's really a tragic situation, and there is no single silver bullet that will solve it, but we need to start doing the things that we know can reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfire.
See, I worked for about a year as a reporter in Spokane. Do you suppose any of the local reporters are going to be going to those same environmental groups saying, hey, was this a mistake on your part to block these activities that would have made this area more fire safe? Because my impression is the local media will be in the same boat, and they'll simply say, no, we don't need to go bother those people, even though, you know, the same kind of environmental groups are doing the same thing on the western side of both states, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that there is not enough accountability for activist organizations when the, you know, impact of their policies come home to roost. And again, I don't know, you know, I think it's real mixed in this situation. There are obviously structures and houses, so there's a lot of things going on here. But we do know that we need to manage our forests better, and that certainly will probably have played a role somewhere along this. You know, I actually wrote an article in the Spokesman Review last year saying, you know, here are predictions that the environmental community in Spokane has made that have turned out to be wrong. And I got an email from somebody saying, boy, you're really tough on these people. Why are you so mean to them? And it's like, well, this is why, because their policies have consequences and real people get harmed.
Yeah. And the thing I don't understand is these groups that call themselves environmentalists. I was sharing with my audience, we actually spent the night in Airway Heights last Tuesday night, and then left on Wednesday on the return from a little family vacation to Idaho. So we were right in the area where the fires happened over this last weekend. But on the drive back, you know, we chose to go through Yakima and then a Highway 12 that goes through some really pretty areas. But I was pointing out to my adult stepdaughter, I said, see all these trees that have burned in previous fires? I said, but they're not in doing the salvage logging. I said, you know what they're doing? They're drying out. So the next time there is a fire, and there will be one, because the brush down below it will set those trees back on fire, except now they'll have been staying there dead and drying out for the last couple of years. So they're making great fuel for the next fire that comes along. This is the kind of thing that is done in the Northwest routinely, and it sets us up for what happened, like what happened in Spokane.
And what you will hear is, well, it costs a lot of money to do this. Well, Washington State spends a lot of money. We have, you know, literally billions of dollars from the CO2 taxes, but instead of spending it on doing things that can prevent the next catastrophic wildfire, we spend it on, you know, air quality programs that just go to special interest groups. We spend it on social justice efforts that don't actually help the planet. So we have lots of money. We are just spending it in all the wrong places, and I hope that that gets reconsidered.
Well, and it's funny that you say that, because here's the, and you tell me I'm wrong about this, Todd. I'm talking to Todd Myers from Washington Policy. If you wanted to justify spending some of the CO2 money, you know, the Climate Commitment Act, this nonsense that when you're in Post Falls, Idaho, I can tell you gasoline is over a dollar cheaper than going 20 miles to the west to Spokane. You say, well, how do we justify spending it on salvage logging? I said, because all those rotting trees, as they stand there on the stump, dead, dying, becoming fuel, and during the next fire, maybe falling down and killing a firefighter or two, they're rotting, and they're turning in, and that rot turns into methane, which then degrades into CO2. So you could justify the removal and the salvage logging of all those trees using Climate Commitment Act dollars, couldn't you?
You absolutely could, and what you need, the other part of that is that you need to do it quickly. You don't want to wait a couple of years, because in many cases there is some residual value for those. Not a lot. It's still going to cost you more than you're going to make, but you can offset some of those costs by getting back that residual value of those trees of salvage logging. That helps you do more and make that money go farther, but of course we don't do that. We wait a very long time and lose a lot of that value.
Yeah, because, I mean, I guess for me to wrap my head around what the environmentalists believe in, they say if that tree is damaged and it's dead, then cutting it down and getting some residual value out of it, removing it so it doesn't just rot and become CO2 and methane, you know, we'd rather have it just stand there and rot in place. And maybe one of these days people will be up hiking or camping and the tree will just fall over and kill them. Or maybe there will be another fire and then there will be a big pile of handy fuel to fuel that fire. I would love to have some of the environmental groups come on this show. We invite them all the time and say, how do you justify setting the region up for more of these fires? It doesn't make any sense. That is Todd Myers. He's Vice President for Research at the Washington Policy Center. Todd, it's a pleasure to have you on. Back in a moment, we're going to talk about what happened at the In-N-Out Burger in Twin Falls, Idaho on Saturday. It's a great warning, and then I'll get you your phone calls and emails. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. You're selling a luxury.
Taxes. What say you, Robin Hood?
So you think you're overtaxed?
Overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope?
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Let me go first to Don Benton, who's called in. Don, of course, was a state rep and a state senator, and also served as head of selective service for a time. You've got a concern about the Clark County elections right now, don't you?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Lars. I'm very concerned because turnout as of yesterday or Saturday was about 16%. And so, and this is how these crazy far left people move forward, is that voters just don't pay much attention to the primary. So if you're a resident of Clark County and you have not yet sent your ballot back, it is critical that you vote today and get that ballot put in. Otherwise, you're going to elect candidates that you may not like. You have a choice between two people you that are terrible in the general election. So make sure that the conservative candidates move forward by getting your ballot in the primary, right? Especially for the auditor's election here in Clark County. I lean querying O'Brien is the key to clean elections in the future here in Clark County. We've got to elect O'Brien as a county auditor. She's the only candidate that will clean up the voter rolls here in Clark County. It's critically important.
Well, believe me, I've already explained to my audience, Tina and I take our election ballots in on election day, and we drop them in the box, you know, in person. I don't trust it to the mails, and, you know, the postal workers can take that as they choose, but the problem is the postal system has admitted both in Oregon and other places that they've had real problems getting election ballots delivered back to where they need to go. So I would encourage everybody, if you haven't voted yet and you listen to Don's advice, mark the ballot and then take it down yourself and put it right in the election drop box.
And there are several, you know, election drop boxes around town. I think the most secure is the one that's right there by the elections office, you know, downtown on Franklin. And that's a 24/7 thing. You can drop it off there anytime, day or night. It's open. But you got to do it. And the other thing I want to caution people against is these nonpartisan or so-called nonpartisan races. You know, you can make the office nonpartisan, but you can't make the person that holds the office nonpartisan.
Nope.
And that's the way the Democrats hide their crazy far left feelings, is that they claim it's a nonpartisan deal. Well, that's not the way it really works when they get in there. And so, recommendations for the nonpartisan office, the ones that are challenged, would certainly be Michelle Belcott in District 2, Brian Scholl in District 1, and Peter Silliman in District 5. Those are your three county commissioner seats that are up this year.
Let me ask you something. Is it possible, not just in Clark County, because my show serves all three states, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, is it possible for the party to actually get together with a list of recommendations? I mean, you don't have to say this is the Republican candidate for Washington Supreme Court or any of the other court positions, but you could as a party choose to say these candidates get our endorsement even though they are for nonpartisan races. Would that have some value? Because it's the most common question I get from listeners. Hey, Lars, give me all your recommendations for all three states, for all races down to county, you know, county commission or city council or whatever. And I don't have the staff, nor do I have the time to be able to do that. And with many of them, the judges, it would take gathering information that is going to be very difficult to gather, but it's exactly the kind of thing that a political party could do if they chose to put some resources to it. What do you think of that?
Absolutely. And kudos to the Clark County Republican Party, because they've done that. They did a mailer in the primary this year, just a week ago or two, that lists their recommendations, even in the nonpartisan position. And so I totally agree with that concept. I think parties should get involved, because those of us that have been involved in politics, we know full well there's no such thing as nonpartisan, right?
No.
These people have ideas and concepts and policies and, you know, things they want to do, and they're either conservative ideas or they're far left ideas.
That is absolutely right. Don Benton, thank you very much. Let's go to Linda. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind today?
It has to do with the fires.
Yep.
I'm a 34-year Forest Service retiree. One of the things I did recently, I was driving out to meet friends in a campground. There's been a total fire ban on the Gifford Pinchot National Forest. Most public lands in both Washington and Oregon as of July 1.
Yeah.
I'm driving to the campground. This family group has a fire going in the fire ring. Being the public servant that I was, I stopped and I said, "You can't have a fire." The old guy came up to me and he goes, "Who are you to tell us what we can and can't do?" And I'm a retiree. I know the rules. If your fire starts a fire, you're going to pay suppression costs. And I have been on many hand crews on forest fires I know the dangers. I know the cost. I know the policies. And I'm a conservative, and I realize what the tree hugger environmentalists have done to hand tie the agencies to prevent thinnings, tree removal, to help fight or to stop these catastrophic fires.
No, and you're absolutely right to have warned those people. Although the thing that weakens that message, the fact that all of us see the homeless out there who get a chance to break the rules, and there's no enforcement at all, but I appreciate your call. Let's go to Troy. Hey, Troy, what's on your mind?
I'm concerned about Mayor Katie Wilson. She's pretty much failed Seattle as far as putting public safety at risk and everything. And I'm not sure if there's any way that she can be removed from office or talked into stepping down, just like she did to the fire chief, threw him under the bus. Of course, he was AWOL during the
You mean the police chief,
And he was back east, and he wasn't in Seattle.
Yeah, because he doesn't live here. I mean, he doesn't live in Seattle. He lives in Chicago, Illinois. He commutes. He treats a 300,000-plus job as a part-time job. I mean, I'm not impressed by that. But Katie Wilson is even worse. A young lady who doesn't even, well, has never had a real job in her life. Mommy and daddy pay her bills, and now she's in charge of Seattle. Just wait. The voters chose her, and they're going to get
the Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather. Dropping a Portland truth bomb.
My favorite thing about living in Portland is no matter how many fentanyl overdoses happen, no matter how many tents get set up, you can't blame black people for that.
Back to Lars.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, deep inside a mountain in Iran, buried about 100 meters, that's more than 300 feet underground, sits a nuclear site that the U.S. has never touched until now. Is Pickaxe Mountain Iran's last nuclear hideout? I thought we'd put that question first to Andrea Stricker, who is deputy director of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies in the Non-Proliferation Program and an FDD research fellow. Andrea, welcome to the program.
Great to join you, Lars.
Would you mind telling my audience what Pickaxe Mountain is all about, or at least as much as we know about what's going on under that mountain?
You said it very well. Pickaxe Mountain is very deeply buried. It's essentially a tunnel complex near the Natanz nuclear site that the U.S. destroyed back in June 2025. Now, Iran claims that it was building a centrifuge assembly facility down in this mountain. Not a harmless project. The Western intelligence agencies believe that it may also house an enrichment facility to reestablish Iran's capability to make nuclear weapons fuel and potentially future weaponization activities. The Israelis, in fact, caught Iran moving 1,000 or so centrifuges to that mountain sometime after the June 2025 strikes in the fall.
So does that mean that they were able to get those out of the place that we had just bombed the daylights out of?
I don't know that detail for sure, but I think perhaps they had them located at a different facility and were able to move those for safekeeping.
Okay, I get questions all the time, as Stricker, who's from people who say, well, how do we even know that they're trying to get weapons? And I said, well, you know, the basic, and I'll expect you to know more about this than I do, but nuclear fuel for nuclear reactors to produce electricity is, what, maybe 6% enriched, whereas bomb material is north of 60. I think it might even be as high as 90%. And the difference is all the difference in the world. Between 6% and 60% or 90% or the higher amount, and that if you have centrifuges, the purpose of those is to highly enrich uranium, and the only reason to do that is to build bombs, not power plants, correct?
That's correct. Everything you said is right. Iran is the only non-nuclear weapon state in the world that is making 60% enriched uranium. The reason it's doing that is because it allows it to get as close as possible, actually days from 90%. Thankfully, the United States and Israel have stopped that. They can no longer enrich uranium that we know of. unless they have restarted something at Pickaxe Mountain. And so I think it's really important that the Trump administration not leave this as a hanging thread once Trump leaves office. He needs to act to at least disable Iran's access to the facility, if not try to do it altogether.
Well, and what is the proper way to get at something that's sitting 300 or 100 meters, 300 feet under this mountain?
Well, there's some doubt that the massive ordnance penetrator, the bunker buster bombs that the United States used to take out Natanz and Fordo, the other deeply buried enrichment site, would actually work because they may not be able to penetrate down that low. So what you could be looking at is access denial. You could collapse the tunnel entrances to just prevent Iranian officials and scientists from being able to finish construction, from being able to stockpile materials or assets there. From being able to come and go, essentially, which is what we did at the Esfahan tunnel complex as well, which has Iran's highly enriched uranium stockpile down in there. And then you can continue that policy. Any American president can keep monitoring on that site and essentially eliminate anybody who tries to come near it. And then another option is an on-the-ground raid. That's much more risky for U.S. personnel and troops, and it might take some time to get down in there and destroy all assets.
Now, let me ask you something, Andrea, because over the years, I've been fascinated by some of the programs that they had, and then they said they did, that we had, and that we said, well, we didn't go ahead with that. Do the rods from God actually exist? And if so, could they be applied to Pickaxe Mountain?
I'm not sure about that, but we certainly need to have some on-the-ground options if, for example, we have intelligence that Iran is breaking out at the facility, is enriching uranium again. I think we need to work with our Israeli partners to have a force ready to go down inside the facility and maybe booby trap and bomb any assets they can get their hands on and potentially prevent the Iranians from finishing it.
Okay, and from the point of view of FDD, is there any real potential that Iran will change its tune at some point and say, okay, we'll stop pursuing nuclear weapons, we may pursue electric generation of power by nuclear means, but we're not going to do the weapons anymore? Any realistic possibility that that's going to happen?
It's not realistic until the regime is fully defeated. Otherwise, they're going to hang on to their option to build nuclear weapons as much as they possibly can. And their modus operandi for their past nuclear weapons efforts has been to do whatever they can get away with. And so this applies here. I think also they are highly incentivized to pursue nuclear weapons to prevent the United States or Israel from attacking again and to have some form of deterrence. Our intelligence people need to be all over this threat and watching for any reconstitution efforts.
You know, the other question that I've pondered this year, and that is, you know, we've had previous presidents, including Obama and others, who said the Iranians cannot be allowed to get nuclear weapons. Fine. So when I hear the left side of America's political aisle, the Democrats, say, well, why are we doing this and why is this a war of choice? Was Donald Trump in a position where he didn't really have any choice but to do something about the threat because the threat was that real? Or could he have put it off and said, I'll make it the next guy's problem?
I think he really saw that he had to be the one to act because the program had become so advanced under President Biden. The Iranians had essentially gotten about 6 months from nuclear weapons, and they could potentially carry out 4 months of that breakout project without being observed. So they would only have to divert their fuel in the last 2 months, and then they would be at the nuclear weapons threshold and potentially unstoppable. So I think Trump saw that there was very limited time to act reliably, and so he took his opportunity, and thank goodness he did, because it's made the world a lot safer.
Yeah, because every time I heard that war of choice nonsense from the left, and I think it's nonsense, I kept thinking, you know, if Donald Trump were asked, would you like to go in and do this, you know, kinetic action against Iran in the middle of a major election year where it's going to decide potentially whether or not Republicans, conservatives, and otherwise hold control of the House and the Senate or not, I think he would have said, yeah, I'd rather do it any other year but this year. So the fact that he acted, I don't think was, in my mind, about a choice. It was that I don't have any choice. We have to act on this now, not because he thought it was something he really wanted to do.
That's right. But also we've seen President Trump as a young man talking about the Iranian threat, the Iranian nuclear threat. I think he just knew that this had to be the chance that he acted because no other president was willing to. not even President Bush. And so if no one was going to do it, you had to do it and take all the repercussions, including elections.
Exactly. That is Andrea Stricker. Andrea is Deputy Director at the FDD, the Non-Proliferation Program, and at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. And you need a simple solution.
Have something to say? Give Lars a call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I want to talk about what happened in Twin Falls, Idaho, over the weekend at an In-N-Out Burger. You know, that's the very, very famous and very well-run. I don't have any financial connections to In-N-Out Burger, but I admire the way they do business. But they have an outlet in Twin Falls, Idaho, and a man, a killer, a murderer, who's dead, by the way, and that's a good way for murderers to end up. Chad Williams, on 24 years of age, shows up on Saturday afternoon at the In-N-Out Burger in Twin Falls, Idaho. He murders three people. He injures at least seven others and then took his own life with a self-inflicted gunshot wound. So he's a killer and he's a coward. But one of the things that I think deserves an awful lot of, enhanced attention, and that is that a young man who was also showing up at the In-N-Out Burger, he was there with his girlfriend, and he had prepared for, he says, his entire life for this, carried a concealed pistol, pulled that pistol out, and began shooting. And he was very much outmatched by the killer, Chad Williams, because Chad Williams had a rifle, a long gun, much more accurate at a distance. A pistol, even in the hands of somebody who's very, very good with a pistol, is not much good past about 75 to 100 feet at the most. So he's outmatched, but he's laying down fire. And in this case, the police say that man, Jordan Salinas, managed to get the bad guy to put his head down and to go away from the direction of more victims, which means that Jordan Salinas likely saved lives by taking the actions that he did. Now, how much do we know about Chad Williams? Not. But I will tell you a couple of things that are my general observation. When we have a shooting like this, it is important to find out why, even if it was an insane reason, and usually when it comes to people who show up at a place and just start murdering people, it's going to be a reason that doesn't sound entirely rational to those of us who are rational. But in this case, I know there are people in the media who've decided we are not going to name the killer or shooter, as most of the media choose to call them. I think that's a bad decision in two ways. Number one, don't call him a shooter. Call him a killer. And the reaction I've had to that suggestion from people is, no, we have to call him a shooter because there's been no indictment. There's been no trial. He's dead. He will never stand trial for what he did. He is a killer. If your own eyes and ears cannot determine that, at least consider your audience and tell them. One, call him what he is. He's a killer, not a shooter. A shooter is somebody like me that goes to a gun range and puts holes in paper targets. If you put holes in human beings, you're either a killer or an attempted murderer, one of the others. Call them what they are. And second, there is this new tradition in the mainstream media, not required by law, could not be required by law in a country with a First Amendment, that says we're not going to name the killer because it'll glorify him. He's dead. There is nothing that is going to glorify him. And frankly, I've found that when you name those people, not because you want to make them more famous or infamous, but because you oftentimes will hear additional details from people who say, oh, I worked with that guy a couple of years ago. I knew him well. And they will give you information you never would have heard otherwise. If you refuse to name him, and that's what a lot of the news media are doing, you're simply saying, whatever the government tells me about the killer is what I will pass on to my audience. I will not do any independent investigation. That is not doing your job. Twin Falls Police said on Sunday afternoon at least one other person who is an active duty service member had been the target of online harassment because, unfortunately, he shares the same name as the suspect. Law enforcement is saying, please don't bother this other guy who happens to have the same name as the killer. And that is one of the downsides to giving names, but it is not a good justification not to name the killers and not to call them what they are. They are killers. I also raised the question, there was a massive wildfire west of Spokane, Washington, in an area called the Airway Heights area. Thousands of acres on fire, hundreds of homes and other buildings burned to the ground. 60,000 people evacuated because of the fires over the weekend. But what made it worse is that looky-loos with drones, most of these are toys, sometimes very sophisticated toys, were putting those drones in the air at a time when real aircraft that were helping to fight the fire were also in the air, and that forced the grounding of all that. And the fine for that is only $500, and I suggested that is not nearly enough, and that got some reaction. Annie, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Thank you. The thought crossed my mind that if these drones are in a restricted area, shoot them down.
Yeah, the only downside to that, Annie, is do you know what usually powers those drones these days? It's lithium-ion batteries. Do you know what happens when one of those batteries is pierced by a nail or by, you know, a shotgun pellet or a bullet? They contain a lot of energy, and they can become explosive. Mm. I don't know if you've seen the pictures when a battery-powered Tesla catches fire. It takes mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands of gallons of water to put them out. So I think shooting down is not only illegal, there are federal laws that say it's illegal to shoot down drones. And you might say, well, but if law enforcement does it, yeah, I don't think that does any good. I want to find the people who own that drone, and I want to make sure mm-hmm. that they understand there's a penalty. And $500, somebody pointed out to me, throwing a lit cigarette out the window brings a $900 fine. How is it that putting all those aircraft on the ground because you put a drone up has a fine about half as much? Seems like the costs ought to be a lot more, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly.
And that would be the problem with shooting them down, but I appreciate the suggestion. David, what do you have to say?
Hey, Lars. Love your show.
Thank you.
It occurred to me that... Hey, you're welcome. It occurred to me while this subject was going on earlier, that the fine should be 10 times that much, so $5,000. But then
that's
I thought,
fair.
Well, you know, that's really not enough. And then I started thinking maybe 100 times, $50,000. That is a life-changing amount of money.
Yep.
If people know that they're going to have to mortgage their home or be in debt for 20 years, maybe they'll think twice about endangering both the firefighters on the ground, the aircraft in the air, and the rest of the people whose houses and buildings and businesses may be in the line of fire.
That is a very excellent suggestion. Leave it up to the judge. Say, Judge, it can be a minimum of 5, a maximum of 50. You decide based on the circumstances.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.
Lars.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So two bystanders die at a Seattle food festival in the 13th biggest city in the United States of America. And days later, the police chief is fired from his job, and the mayor, who is a young lady who has never had a real job in her life, has had her mom and dad paying her bills, doesn't seem like she's very responsible at all. Out of one side of her mouth, Katie Wilson is promising transparency. Meanwhile, out of the other side of her mouth, she says, but you, the public, are not allowed to know why I fired Chief Sean Barnes. Now, the guy who's one of those on the ground who's been doing yeoman's work when it comes to this story is journalist Jonathan Cho with the Discovery Institute and Turning Point USA Frontlines, host of Citizen Journalist with Jonathan Cho. Jay Cho, welcome back.
Hey, Lars. Nothing ceases to amaze me anymore. What's going on with the politics in Seattle?
Well, it's crazy because here's the thing. Katie Wilson comes right and says, I'm going to deliver transparency. And then she says, she's asked, well, what was it that went on between you and Chief Sean Barnes right before you decided to fire him and have to pay him almost 2 years of salary to get rid of him? And she says, those conversations are private. And they're confidential. I'm not allowed to tell you. Number one, I think that's a lie. But is there any way to justify a mayor saying, I fired the chief, but I can't tell you what we talked about or why I decided to fire him? And by the way, I'm going to promise you transparency at the same time that I'm giving you opacity.
Yeah, I think her constituents, the voters, at the very least now, even the local media, have all caught on. Mayor Katie Wilson, the socialist mayor, has no idea what she's doing, and her promises of transparency and trying to do the right thing, all of that went out the window, when all she had to do really was lay out what were the reasons, what did he violate? I mean, this is routine when people are fired or let go from a job, right? What
Yep.
were the reasons? And we're simply being told, the only clarity we've had is it was related to some of the handling around the tragic Seattle Center mass shooting last weekend.
Well, and so you have the mass shooting, and then you have a delay in holding a press conference to communicate to the public. And frankly, Jay Cho, one of the things I wanted to ask you about directly, isn't there still a third suspect from the shooting still running around loose, or has he been caught? Jay Cho, did I lose you? Oh, shoot. What a terrible time to lose connection with Jonathan Cho. Let me see if we can get him back. Joel, will you see if we can get Jay Cho back on? We're going to reconnect with him. But imagine this. You have a shooting. One of the alleged shooters is dead, although he keeps getting mentioned by the mayor as somebody whose family she feels sympathy for. Jay Cho, we lost you at just that critical moment. Isn't there a third suspect who's still running around loose? And what's happened to that part of the story?
Yeah, Interim Chief Andre Sale says the actual shooter, the one who allegedly killed these three people, is still on the loose. But he's also now saying that there could be multiple suspects they're looking for as well related to this gang shooting.
I would think that would be one of the key focus. If you've got a killer and an alleged killer is on the loose and running around and not in custody, it would seem to me that's a tremendously dangerous person, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's some of the criticism that the mayor as well as the former police chief Sean Barnes faced. It was the slow response to let the community know that a killer was still on the loose. If you recall, it took more than 5 hours before the mayor or SPD even put out any information or held a press release to notify the public that anyone's, you know, either people have been arrested or not. And I think that's some of the greatest frustration and also warranted criticism right now of Mayor Katie Wilson.
Okay, and let me ask you this, because Jay Cho, you cover Seattle regularly. I don't as closely, but tell me this. Hasn't this chief arguably done a good job? I didn't like the fact that he appeared to be a part-timer and a carpetbagger and commuting every week to Chicago. But all of that aside, did he bring crime down? Did he bring recruitment up? Did he hit the marks that he was told to hit? Then was there any justification to actually fire him other than Katie Wilson being embarrassed?
Yeah, it's really hard to justify this firing, especially during the middle of a high-profile murder investigation. I think that's unprecedented. Number two, I saw his performance review, at least the one that was shown by some civil rights activists. His most recent performance review showed that he received an A grade, that he was going, you know, above and beyond as chief. Now, again, as you mentioned, there was some criticism about his travel to Chicago, where he has a second home. His wife and kids still live there. Also, as our friend Ari Hoffman has reported in the past, Sean Barnes failed a polygraph when he came in to this administration. And again, Katie Wilson inherited this chief, this former chief, but she also had a choice to bring him on or not. So she very well should have known, again, his background and his potential baggage.
I'm talking to Jonathan Cho, who's a journalist with the Discovery Institute and Turning Point USA. Last issue, and that's this. Katie Wilson makes the claim, I knew I had to fire him because I have a special window into knowing what's going on inside the police bureau. But then she admits she had no idea why they didn't hold the press conference right away and tell the public. She had no idea that Chief Sean Barnes had apparently missed 50 days of work because of this commuting back and forth. She appeared to have been clueless about what was going on inside the city's police bureau, but then claims, I know the special inside insights into what's going on, and that's why I knew enough to fire him, but sorry, I can't tell you why I fired him. Does any of that make sense?
No, it doesn't, and right now there are more questions than answers right now over this. I spoke to many reporters in that room for her final press conference on Friday, and we've all filed public disclosure requests, communications between, you know, SPD and the mayor's office, because I think at this point that's the only way we're going to find out really what happened.
Okay, so Jade Cho, is there a process for removing her? Could the city council move to remove her? Would it have to be a vote of citizens to remove her? And has anybody raised the question, if you're this incompetent, why should you keep your job?
Yeah, that word recall has been thrown around a lot. In fact, off the record, several council members have told me they're looking into that. The council can potentially trigger this. But again, we're not quite there yet, still in the very early stages. But the vast majority of the Seattle City Council have all now said publicly that they no longer have confidence in socialist Seattle Mayor Katie Wilson leading the city.
Yeah, and is anybody going to ask the question, how does a woman or a man get a job like this, who's never had a position of responsibility in her entire life? She's got a baby. She's got a husband. He doesn't work. She doesn't work. Mom and dad pay her bills. And somehow she ends up in charge of America's 13th biggest city. It seems absolutely unbelievable. And frankly, it seems like it's more than a little bit dangerous for the people who live there. Jade Cho, thanks very much. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Market exposure.
Disagree with Lars? Great. Naysayers go first at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll bet that you're one of those people who thinks that the W in WNBA stands for women. Well, it does officially stand for women, but that doesn't necessarily mean that women are going to find things friendly in the WNBA. Let me get into the details of why I believe that. And in fact, a couple of the comments from one of the top coaches of a WNBA team called the Valkyries. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you're a naysayer, naysayers on this program have always gone to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And our poll on X question today, it has to do with the fact that when there are emergencies in the United States, that oftentimes there are aircraft that serve the public in those emergencies. During fires, and it's summertime, so fires are fairly common, you may have aircraft that are serving as spotters. You may have aircraft that are dumping water or retardant on tops of fires. They are certainly serving the public. And anytime somebody launches a drone, one of these drones you can usually pick up for a very small amount of money. Oftentimes, they're little more than toys, although some of these drones literally can cost hundreds or even thousands of dollars. They have sophisticated systems on them, but the people who operate the drones don't seem to understand that every time you put a drone in the air, another aircraft in the air, if one of those aircraft hits that drone, it's not just bad news for the drone owner. It may be that you will cause the aircraft, whether it's a helicopter or a fixed-wing airplane, to crash. And in that case, you're going to kill people. At the very least, what happens is if drones are spotted in the air over an emergency, as I said, in summertime, it's typically fires. In the other parts of the year, it could be a hurricane. It could be an earthquake. There are a number of different kinds of emergencies that would cause civilian authorities, both federal and local, to put aircraft in the air. It might be helicopters who are lifting people to safety. But the minute the drones are there, they've got to ground all of those aircraft that are actually saving lives because some knucklehead decided to put a drone in the air. Now, this has happened most recently in these massive fires that happened in Spokane, Washington over the last weekend. These were fires so big, they're one of the biggest fire emergencies that has ever happened in the United States. They required the evacuation of 60,000 people. 60,000 people. They caused the destruction of more than 700 homes and businesses and other buildings. They've shut off power for big parts of the population. And then they had drones that were put in the air. Now, two people have been cited as drone operators who had put drones into what was closed airspace. You tell the drone operators, don't put the drone up. It is going to create big problems. The maximum fine is $500. Now, our question in the X poll, should the law offer tougher penalties for drone intrusions to wildfire emergencies? I would actually expand that to be any kind of emergency ought to justify having a fairly large fine to get people's attention. But you can find the X poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. You can also send me emails, talk@LarsLarson.com. Well, right now, the WNBA could actually bring about the end of the WNBA. Now, if you know me, I don't follow a lot of professional sports. Occasionally, we'll talk about athletes because when those sports actually intersect with politics or business or other concerns, I end up talking sports. But I would never claim to be the most knowledgeable person when it comes to sports. But you've now got WNBA coaches who say that men, biological men, should be allowed to play in the WNBA against biological women. And one of them is the coach of a team called the Valkyries, and that's Natalie Nicasi. Take a listen to her defense of this ridiculous position.
I think, thank you for that question. I think just in terms of how I'm seeing it is, if I could answer, with like, for me, sports is about belonging. It's about inclusivity. It's about allowing everyone to be their authentic self. You know, I'm big on that just because I have been criticized for my height, for my ethnicity. I've been in those, you shouldn't belong here, many times. And for me, I don't want that space, especially Golden State, to ever feel like that. So I'm all about women, little girls deserving to play, and that includes trans women.
That includes trans women, meaning this is a biological woman who says she's been targeted because of her height and because she's Asian. Then she turns around and says, but I want the WNBA to be inclusive of women, but that includes trans women, which is a term that means biological men who identify mentally as women. And she includes them. So she says that men ought to be able to play in the WNBA. Well, how does that make any sense? We've already seen what happens in sports like swimming, track and field, weightlifting, wrestling, boxing, any of those sports where you say, oh, we're going to let biological men pretend to be women and go in and they absolutely hammer the daylights out of women. They beat them for time. They beat them for capabilities. And it doesn't make any sense. But now you've got the WNBA, which I think already has its share of problems because they have a very popular player by the name of Caitlin Clark that apparently most of the women in the WNBA who happen to be women of color don't like Caitlin Clark. She's got a defender in Sophie Cunningham who's actually defended her and said, look, you can't do these things to people. So you've got a WNBA that doesn't earn its share, number one. Number two is not that popular to begin with. And number three, now you've given every sensible parent who has children who are girls, actual biological girls, another reason to avoid going to the WNBA. Can you imagine telling somebody, why don't you take your daughter down to the WNBA? Maybe she'll be inspired to take part in an athletic contest. And then tell your daughter, oh, by the way, that player out there, it just looks taller and bigger because it's actually a biological male who's pretending to be a female. And if you take part in this kind of athletics, that's who you're going to be playing against. Can you imagine any sensible parent doing that to a child? Because I can't. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and... Lars reads every email. No, really. Talk at LarsLarson.com. That's talk at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Well, gas went back above $4 a gallon. Growth has slowed down a bit nationwide, and shoppers keep on spending anyway. How long can businesses continue to eat these costs before consumers have to pay the price? I thought I'd put that question to Con Davis, who's CEO of Byrna Technologies, and I'm sure that Con will start by telling us about Byrna, because I've talked about the subject plenty of times about the kind of technology that Byrna puts in people's hands. Con, welcome back.
You are. It's great to be back with you. And yes, so Byrna Technologies, we manufacture less lethal launchers right here in the United States in Indiana. And what those are is they look a lot like a handgun, but they're not. They're powered by carbon dioxide, and they launch a chemical irritant round that can incapacitate someone from 60 feet away for up to 40 minutes. So it's really a way to keep yourself safe without the fear of pulling the trigger and taking a life.
Yeah, because some people want to carry a pistol. I've had a carry permit for a long time, never had any cause to use it. I mean, I still carry the gun, and it's good to have it. Kind of like I have a spare tire, and I haven't put a spare tire in a car in about 30 years, and I hope I never do. But the point is, if you ever need it and don't have it, it's kind of like a parachute. If you ever really, really need one and you don't have one, you'll never need one again. But Byrna Technologies is for that section of people who say, well, under these circumstances, I don't want to carry a pistol, but I wouldn't mind carrying something that could put the fear of God in the bad guys and keep them at a distance, right?
Well, on top of that, Lars, we are legal in all 50 states. You don't have to have a concealed and carry permit. So if you're traveling, it makes a lot of sense to have this product as you're traveling as well. Additionally, if you're like me and you have small children in your house, it can be a great option because if you make a mistake, it's not going to end someone's life. It'll be a bad day for somebody, but it won't take their life.
Okay, so Con, tell my audience, if I recall correctly, Byrna transitioned back, was manufacturing overseas, and then transitioned back entirely to the United States a few years ago. It's been a while, hasn't it?
It has. We did this really before COVID, so we were ahead of that trend, but we really found that you were able to get the quality manufacturing when you manufacture here in the United States, and you can control your supply chain so much better. And so we moved everything from South Africa to Indiana right before COVID happened.
That's a great move. And is there any reason that other companies shouldn't be able to do the same kind of thing you did, because you're making a consumer product, so price is important, quality is important. You're also making a product that has some technology, and some of it is, you know, a physical structure, like a pistol. So any reason other companies couldn't do the same thing you've done and come back home?
Not at all. I mean, I will tell you, it took us a little while to develop some of the suppliers here in the United States so that we didn't have to import parts and pieces. But with a concerted effort, anyone can do that. And frankly, Lars, when you're doing that, what it gives you is not only better control of your quality, but as you mentioned, these are technology products and we have patents on them. It gives you better protection for your intellectual property rights.
Yeah, because you'd have to be concerned about that stuff getting ripped off by, say China.
Absolutely.
I mean, because China's a notorious thief when it comes to IP. So tell me what your impression is of where our country's economy is going right now. Gross domestic product growing at about 1.5%, not as high as we'd like it to be, but inflation not too far outside the range that they're looking for. Where do we need to go from here?
Well, I'll tell you, the consumer has been really resilient so far in this economy, which has been a little bit surprising to me. Usually when you see what's happened with energy prices and what happened with gasoline prices, the consumer gets pinched pretty hard. But they've been resilient so far. I think we were in a pretty good shape from a credit point of view coming into the current situation, but that can't last forever. And so at some point, you've got to wonder when the consumer starts to squeal. At the same time, you look at manufacturers like us, we're starting to feel a lot of pressure from a freight in and a freight out point of view. And for plastic components, prices across the board, they're going up. If you're like us right now, you're trying to resist raising your prices because, as I'm sure you know, with anyone who sells products through a retail channel, once prices go up, they never come back down. And our point of view is, you know, we want our products to be available to people where they can afford them. So that's key for us.
I'm talking to Con Davis, who's CEO of Byrna Technologies. Used a term I'm not familiar with, freight in, freight out. What does that refer to?
So that's just the shipping. So when we order any part or piece, the shipping coming to us from our suppliers, that's freight in. So that's the cost that I pay for the trucks. And similarly, when I ship something to a consumer and I send it out, that's called freight out. Apologies for the technical term.
No, that makes sense. But does that mean that then you have an incentive to be located as close to your suppliers as possible? I mean, it's not really possible for you to be as close to consumers as you'd like, because I assume your customers are coast to coast.
They are coast to coast. But again, what's important there is we manufacture in the U.S. and our supply base is in the U.S. So it's all domestic freight. If we were having to order from China, from other places in Southeast Asia, there are even more costs that are associated with that, for sure.
Okay, so what does the federal government need to do in particular? And is it tariffs relief, or what do you need to do to make things better for manufacturers like Byrna?
So for us, it's really about consistency, right? We've seen tariffs go on and off and on and off. That creates a lot of volatility, and it's hard for us to plan our business around that. The same goes with gas prices. They've been incredibly volatile with everything that's been going on in the Middle East. So for business, what you really need is stability one way or the other. So that's what we're looking for.
Okay, so let me ask about the plastic part of this, because the Byrna is made from plastic. Is that plastic, is the feedstock for that coming from American plants, or is it being mostly made overseas? Because the materials involved are going to be petroleum products, aren't they?
They are. And where we're fortunate is the United States has a great petroleum industry and a great resins and plastics industry that comes out of that, which means I can source all of those things here in the United States, which has insulated us some from those price swings. But as you know, oil is traded all over the globe. And as that goes up, it does capture even our oil here in the U.S.
All right. What's the growth forecast for Byrna going forward?
Well, you know, what's exciting about where we are is it's still early days from a growth point of view for Byrna. So I'm really excited about where we're going. For us, it's all about continuing to introduce this product to new customers so that they know that there's an option out there that they can protect themselves out with without having to take a life, which is really important for us to get that message out.
Con, thank you very much. I appreciate what Byrna does, and we appreciate your time.
You have a great one, Lars. Appreciate you.
And you as well. That is Con Davis, who is CEO of Byrna Technologies. If you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Automotive shop.
Missed the Lars Larson Show? Get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Monday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and we're glad to serve the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. Glad to get your calls, too. And by the way, this segment of the show is brought to you by eLegacy. The fact is you've spent your whole life building your wealth. Don't leave it unprotected. Set your kids or grandkids up for success by creating a customized estate plan with eLegacy. Do this. Go to eLegacy Lars. That's L-A-R-S. eLegacyLars.com and set up a complimentary consultation. Our ex-poll question today, and boy, have I been getting a lot of feedback about this one. Because of the fires this past weekend in Spokane, because they caused the evacuation of 60,000 people, they caused the destruction of more than 700 buildings and homes. Nobody was killed. Nobody was seriously hurt. But a tremendous amount of destruction happened. Should the law offer tougher penalties for drone intrusions at wildfire emergencies? It turns out that in the Spokane area, they had at least a couple of drones that showed up, were spotted, and the minute they were spotted, all of the other aircraft that were actually taking part in helping to fight the fire had to be grounded until they could get the drones out of the area. Well, the authorities in Spokane have said that they have already sighted two individuals, but they were unable to identify some of the other operators. Now, when some idiot flies their drone over a wildfire, all the other aircraft have to be shut down. But right now, the total fine, if they catch you, if they can identify you, if they prosecute you, is $500. And it's been suggested by, among others, some of the hotshot crews, $500 is not nearly enough. In fact, at least one emailer suggested to me, Lars, if you flick a lit cigarette butt out the window of your car, especially in dry areas or during the middle of the summer, the fine is $900. And how can it only be $500 to fly a drone in a way that requires the grounding of all the other aircraft? And they say at 26 different times, firefighters had called in because of unauthorized drones buzzing overhead, which were slowing and probably even halting some operations. Well, the feedback I got, I suggested a tougher penalty. You could imagine thousands of dollars. You could even imagine giving the judge, I know the judges aren't always trustworthy, but give the judge the latitude to say, because of the circumstances of this case, I'm ordering you to spend a week in jail or a night in jail. I know that because of the sentences we hear for crimes like murder and rape and otherwise, we might say a week in jail. I have a feeling. I have been in plenty of jails, not as an inmate, but as a reporter. I've been in plenty of prisons, especially here in the Pacific Northwest. I've been in county jails. I've been in city jails. I've been in state prisons in both Oregon and Washington. I cannot imagine spending even one night in a prison or a jail. Imagine if you're one of those drone operators who's decided to flout the rules and you ended up spending a week in a jail. Can you imagine how that might change your attitude? So Kelly writes in, Lars, good afternoon. I'd like to comment on the drones and the fines. Yes, fines should be significantly increased. I'd even go a bit farther as to add some possible jail time, depending on the offense, as well as treating it as a firearms violation, losing your rights to own a drone. Have a good day. Signed, KP. I can imagine a judge doing exactly that, Kelly. I can imagine a judge saying, as part of your punishment, I'm going to order that you may not possess drones for the next year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever. Court Boyce, who's one of our friends in the state legislature in Oregon. Court, you had a comment about the drones?
Hey, good subject. It's getting to be more and more of a threat. We did pass a bill last session, the short session, Lars, basically to at least get what the Democrats would accept, at least from a misdemeanor to a Class C felony. So
good.
Yeah, it's, you remember in the Palisades fire when a tanker went up and a drone hit the inside of the wing? It was a hole about the size, slightly smaller than a basketball. They landed safely. We had another incident in Eugene where they had to call off a major rescue attempt because there was actually two drones, if I recall, and that halted everything for 2 hours. So good subject, and yeah, it needs even stiffer penalties in my view.
No, see, I'm with you, Court, because imagine this. It may not even be the drone hitting the windscreen or hitting the pilot, but imagine this. Every time I've been around jet engines, you know, on aircraft carriers and things like that, their biggest concern is what they call FOD, foreign object damage. They said something the size of a pen, a ballpoint pen, could do tremendous damage to a jet engine. Imagine a helicopter that's going in to do either Bambi buckets to drop things or to pick people out of an area affected by a fire like Spokane. Imagine one of the jet engines on that helicopter eats a drone, and imagine what happens. That aircraft may come right out of the air.
It's risk of, level of risk that we have to look at, and it's hard enough to get people to go into those careers because of the dangers involved. So, yeah, I was just listening, and you're talking about fire too. You know, we just officially this morning, Lars, went over 2 million acres, which is 100,000 more than we had the record setting 2024 season.
Yeah, and Court, one of the things I've been reminding people is the numbers come from Dr. Bob Zybak, who's a forest scientist. He says we had 30 years where we had heavy activity in the woods, lots of logging going on from the mid-50s to the mid-80s. We had one fire over 100,000 acres, and that was it. Now, imagine if we could get back to that, and the answer is to get people out in the woods logging, you know, do active management, and generate the money necessary to do the fuels reduction. All of that is within reach, except the governments of Oregon and Washington refuse to do it.
It's just heartbreaking, and I'm a big fan of Dr. Zybak, and he has article after article of the common sense approaches. And yeah, you just mentioned a catastrophic fire, one fire in those days, over 100,000 acres. Right now, most urban eastern and central Oregon, as you know, but we have 11 fires over 100,000 acres going at the same time.
And they're going to claim that it's global warming. It's not. If we open up the roads, if we put people back in the woods, if we do active management and generate the money, it can all be taken care of and it doesn't have to cost a lot. Court, thanks very much. That is Court Boyce, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. FM News 101.